Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And today, again, we have another show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality. And it's a continuation of the Life on Earth series, dealing with how life developed on Earth. I'm not going to say evolved. Evolution is part of it, and I thought I'd start with that concept in today's show. If you would like to call in, you can. 877-876-5227 in the U.S. If you're in Canada, 888-815-9756. All right. So we've been talking, and this is, I don't even know what week it is, fourth, fifth, whatever week we're on, it doesn't matter to me. I'm just going to keep going. But we've been talking about how life is really the way that the Creator, God, if you prefer, decided to grow our universe and in essence grow itself, because it is everything that exists in the universe. It's its method of growth. But in human terms, we talk about life growing in many cases, but not everybody says this, through a process that is somewhat defined by interactions of molecules, all the way up to interactions of cells, etc., that is based upon evolution and based upon, therefore, forces in nature and eventually survival of the fittest, with animals adapting through conflicts in their environment. Usually they are conflicts caused by other life forms or by, we'll call it, inanimate things, such as the Earth itself, conditions within the Earth, or on the Earth. All of these factors go into what most people refer to, that believe in, evolution. Now, I want you to know that I believe in evolution, but only from the standpoint that it was created by God as a method of developing life, especially life less than the life of most humans. So that life under, we'll say, conditions in which it is not or cannot be conscious of or aware of the presence of its own creator has to have some means for its own development. And in those cases, because life below human beings cannot be aware of its own creator, the process is relatively mechanical, relatively seemingly superficial, and involves nuances of change that we call adaptations to conditions around it. This is the way, I believe, and so do some others, that the Creator had decided would be best to grow life that could not yet, because of its development, because of the need for life to grow itself, even at the very beginnings of itself, could not become aware of its own creator or conscious of it beyond the awareness. Now you might say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, it's not that hard to understand. Something is aware of a thing like its own creator, or of anything else in its environment, when it chooses to react to that which it's aware of, when it chooses to change its relationship to that which it can become aware of, and it's conscious of that which it can be aware of, when it can give to, or plan with, or, we'll say, have a major way of interacting in which the interaction has a direction to and with that which it is aware of. So if that's true about God, then we could look at animals as an example. Plants could be included in this as well. And say, well, how much do animals do those things with a creator? And the answer is nada. Nothing at all. They don't do that. They do love each other. some of them do. They do show a interaction with, we'll say, each other in many cases, and other kinds of life in some circumstances. But you just don't see any animals that are really going around promoting their relationship with God, building some way of getting closer to God, changing their existence because of their awareness and consciousness of God, givingness with God, trying to emulate God. It just doesn't happen. And if you know of an animal that is doing this, I'm serious, let me know, because I have not seen that ever, ever. I've seen animals love. I've seen animals become emulations of those that are their caretakers and masters, so to speak, us, if they're our pets. That's a little bit. They can kind of pick up a little bit of what we do with our Creator through us, but they can't do it independent of us. Especially if they were, if our pets were left to be wild, they would become quite different than what they are while they're close to humans. So being a human is distinctly different from species below humans. And it's so different that there is a whole different model in how human beings can develop themselves in comparison to how animals and plants, microbes, all of the lot of life itself develops itself. And even pre-life, which is just like, think of it as minerals, as non-living to us sources. All of these other kinds of things develop by forces. They develop by adaptation, if there's some form of life, and they develop by natural selection, which means that the ones that are most capable of adapting win out in terms of developing a habitat and, in some cases, eating or whatever, maybe the other life forms that are around them, because they have survived better than their counterparts. And so, as we look at this theory now, we have to say there has to be something different in the awareness and the consciousness of animals and plants, as and of course minerals, in comparison to human beings. And the difference is, in metaphysical terms, that animals, at most, have five senses. And those five senses have to do with the forms around us in the physical realm. Now, this is something that you may not know, but many of you do. They also have up to five senses in their astral bodies as well. And sometimes they have a couple of senses or more pieces of a sense in their monastic or mental bodies. That's great. What does that mean? Well, they can sense the material world around them, but they can't sense the spiritual world around them. They can't sense spirit itself, which is the thought of their own creator. And they can't sense the interactions between themselves and their creators, and between their creator and all of their life, meaning they cannot sense the mind of God in total, its thought or its interactions with its world. They can't do that because they are missing two senses that we have. They have those five, up to the five senses, and most animals, by the way, don't even have five, but we'll say the more advanced animals, they do have five. And then humans have two extra senses. Everybody says, well, oh, wait a second, science says we have five senses. No, we actually have seven. The other two are the heart center, or chakra, some people prefer to call it that, that resides around in the area of the heart. That's how it gets its name. It isn't the heart itself, although the heart, in a way, is, as an organ, is developed as a result of part of the senses' existence. It's not whether or not you can sense God if you have a heart or not. It just means part of that sense is used in the development of that organ. And the heart chakra gives us the ability to understand, first of all, be aware of our Creator, and to understand, if we choose to, something or some things about what it is like. Humans have this capability. Animals do not. Okay. And then there's a set, that's a sixth sense. The seventh sense and center is called the crown chakra. It's above the head. It's not even located exactly in the physical body. It's above it in what is sometimes referred to as the etheric part of the physical body. And in the astral body, it lies outside of the form part, the looking form part of the human, but it's still there. And the same is true in the monastic body. So what we have is then we have three senses in, six senses in three different bodies that deal with understanding God, and then the part that is the highest, the part that is in the head chakra, the crown chakra, is actually capable of not only understanding God, but co-creating with God. In other words, this sense goes beyond just an understanding. It gives us the ability to see ourselves as what we are, a reflection of our own creator. And I guess some people might say vice versa. Yes, it's possible. And so this is a remarkable thing. It gives us this incredible ability to actually emulate the creative nature of God in ourselves and with others. That's where the crown chakra really shines and is able to give us an awareness of it, and then the ability to give with it and become a co-creator. An amazing, amazing thing. Now, these two centers in the three different bodies, at a minimum, by the way, so it's a total of six, gives us a great deal more in terms of our ability to be spiritual, which means to understand the thought of our Creator, and to be interactive with our Creator, allowing us to fully engage the mind of our Creator. The mind is really made up of two parts of thought, which is we call spirit, and then the third part, which we call interaction. Now, I don't want to lose you on that, but I'm just trying to piece it all together for those of you who have heard me talk about this before. This puts us way outside the realm of evolution, because evolution is really relatively mechanical. It's based upon all of these energies, forces, one energy going against another inside and outside of a thing, a being, or a life form, and forcing change. Now, if you want to become forced by change, then I guess you could ignore, and some people do this, their spiritual senses, which is the heart and crown chakra in each of the three bodies I mentioned, and they can become very much like their, we'll say, pets, or maybe less than that, and become more animal-like, and no longer follow in the, we'll say, footsteps, as well as in the co-creation with God, and become separated to some extent from that. That's all because of choice. We have that choice. Some of us make the wrong choice in that respect because we go in the more animalistic direction, and that causes us to become dark and selfish and destructive to ourselves and others and on and on. This is critical. God chose this to be the case. It isn't happenchance. It isn't that human beings just happen to have these remarkable differences from other life. It's actually designed to be this way because life's goal is at least at a minimum to reach the human level of development and to go beyond it. And in order to grow and co-create our Creator in an active sense that isn't based just upon forces and, we'll say, chaos and probabilities, we've got to be willing and to choose the direction to be our own creator, our co-creator, and to work with, and well, to see and work with God. If we don't do that, then we suffer, because suffering comes from a loss of consciousness, which is a result of turning away from the part of the spiritual element of us. And we become very, very limited because forces, amazingly, while they do tend to grow life, they grow it very slowly. And in comparison to the rate at which humans can grow, it is extremely limiting. And eventually, if humans don't enter into the picture, the odd thing about evolution is in its long, long, long range, it eventually kills itself off. Because it is competitive, and because it doesn't have the ability to consciously, or even in an awareness sense, cooperate with its creator, it's doomed to eventually destroy itself. And this is unfortunate that most people don't recognize this, because some people say, well, why don't we solve all the problems of this planet? We'll just get rid of humans. Because the humans, after all, are causing a lot of problems. And then we can allow the life in the planet to grow. Or in some cases, they just say, well, let's limit human contact or limit the way we change things. Well, that's not the solution, because ultimately life needs humans to bring spirit to it and to help to change life to become greater and greater, both in humans themselves and eventually in the lower kingdoms, so that evolution is not such a powerful force controlling all of life. Rather, evolution becomes less and less important as humans become more spiritual and take charge over life that's within their domain. And that domain is usually a planet. So as we look at this whole situation, there's a plan out there. It's more than just some kind of rolling of the dice and let's see what goes on. This is a system. There's a design. The design is hidden because only those who have developed their heart and crown chakras far enough can see it. You can read about it and you can have a great intellect about what my quote-unquote explanations are and others. But if you don't have those centers working very well, the result can be that it's just a bunch of words that doesn't make any sense, and you're back to being an evolutionist hard and fast with no concern or thought about there being anything beyond that. And that's a problem, because you can be very bright, you can be very well educated, and another center called the Ajna Center can be working extremely well, yet without the crown and heart chakras going, or I should say probably the opposite way, but it doesn't matter, people are lost. They can't see, no matter how much you explain what I just said, that it's true. Because you can always come up with, and this is unfortunate, but it's the way God chose it to be, you can always come up with some evolutionary explanation for the way lower life is created. Because basically, even in this world right now, until you're in a very advanced world, you can't see, you can't notice that humans actually can radically change life towards the better, and that we really are spiritual beings, and here to do exactly that. Here it's not evident at all because we're screwed up. So for most people, they say, well, it'd be better if humans weren't here because we're messing things up so badly. So you can see how that's a problem in a more primitive type on an average world, such as Earth is, in comparison to some other places. We're still at that stage where it is difficult to look at our world and say anything other than evolution is the only thing that exists. And spiritual development is a bunch of hogwash, because humans, if they have anything to do with it, are not doing very good. Well, that's true. It's a true statement. But it doesn't see the ultimate goal. So that's the problem. And you might say, well, what about other worlds? Yes, I've talked about other worlds, and I say, and I'll tell you this, that life is ubiquitous. That means it's around everywhere. But it's in different forms and in different ways. And in many worlds, it doesn't exist in the physical realm. It exists in either the etheric, the astral, or mental, or beyond. And for all intents and purposes, we would think those are vacant planets, and they have nothing to do with us. Most of the time, they are gaseous planets that have almost no dense form, except maybe in the very center of them. And so the ultimate reality is to us, well, there's very few, if any, planets that have other life on them. Well, actually, there's still a lot of planets in the thousands in our galaxy. So maybe single digit, maybe not much more than a couple thousand, actually, of planets that have physical life on them. And the reason for that is physical life is actually the smallest kind of life that can exist. We're in a basement where things are difficult. And it requires a very narrow range of development, even on a galactic scale. You can't be too far out of the galaxy, you can't be too far in the galaxy, you can't be on this side, you can't be on that side. You got to be really very, very close in the way, at least, Earth is structured in relationship to the galaxy for the kind of life that we call physical life to exist. But even though it's such a narrow band, because there are billions and billions, hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy, and because there are even more planets than that, even though you limit it way down by putting it in a relatively narrow region of our galaxy, life, physical life at least, can exist, it's still a huge number of planets at any one time. And if you're talking about life as it resembles life on Earth, it's still, like I said, way over 1,000. So it's a lot of planets. That tells us something. Life, in order to exist on Earth, and that's something that I think if you've been listening to each show, had to have gone through a number of very unique experiences to turn out where we would exist. Otherwise, it would just be slime running around the planet. If there wasn't, as an example, a potential or likely snowball Earth, saying, you know, this is where the Earth became iced over, and forced life into a very, very small niche, and where it had to exist literally below what we call the oceans, into the mantle, near the mantle of the Earth, in the dark, low down, close to where heat would be. And it was the only energy source it had. And where over and over again, life was nearly destroyed. Each time, it made it more capable of doing different kinds of things with its genetic structure and helping it to become more and more adaptable. This, again, is natural selection, but it's at an extreme level and in certain ways that if you'd gone a little bit further, it would have wiped out all the life. It was always just to the point where life would keep going on. And you could say, oh, well, that's just remarkable. Earth is so unique in that. But if that's true, then when we do, and we will, within, 100, a couple of years, we're going to discover all kinds of physical planets that have life on them. Eventually, we will. And when we do, we're going to say, well, Earth isn't the only planet that this happened on, but the odds of it happening on two planets with these kinds of extremes and still developing life is like 1 in 10 trillion. And if it happens on 10 trillion, on 10 planets, it's 1 beyond all the numbers of everything that exists in the whole universe. And you start saying to yourself, well, that's not possible. Those statistics don't work in supporting evolution anymore. There has to be something else going on here, something behind the scenes that is controlling how a planet develops life. It is intelligent. It's not just random. That's important, but unfortunately, for the majority of people on Earth, it will require a lot more time, more than a century possibly, before they will be able to realize what I'm trying to tell you in today's show. That's the unfortunate problem. We are facing these kinds of dilemmas because most people's consciousness isn't high enough to be able to see and understand, be aware and understand, that God is behind life. And so they look at the options, and at the present time, the evidence can be supported by everything we presently know, that evolution is all there is. Now, are there things that are out there that are right staring in the face, and you could, if you noticed them, say, wait a second. Yeah, there are. Particularly if you look at human beings. We're going to get to that probably not in tonight's show, but in the near future, when in the next couple of shows, I'm going to be talking about how humans developed and how there are very big complications and problems about the development of human life, because we has studied it so much further, and we now recognize that there are some serious contradictions. In evolutionary model, compared to what we're finding to be true, things are not stacking up exactly the way they should. And that's a good thing. And especially, it would be especially true if, based upon what I said about human beings being different than animals, that you would discover the lack of evolution in human beings in comparison to other creatures. So we'll talk about that. I'm going to leave that with a little tidbit of thought for a coming show. Tonight, I thought we would pick up where we have left off. And we're right back to the dinosaurs. Yep, we're going to talk about dinos. Another kind of fun subject for me anyway. The creatures that came around right after the end of the Permian period. There was the Devonian and then the Carbonaceous. And eventually, we reached this Permian period where all kinds of reptiles are running around. And actually, some of them were pretty much like mammals, but they were still reptiles. And the Earth decided to change itself, become extremely hot and dry. And the supercontinent decided to start breaking apart. And at the same time, there was a crisis, we'll say, from some types of added astronomical events. We had some, during some of the period of time, say 30, 40 million years, at the end of the Permian and into the next period of time. There was even more catastrophes that took place, such as some asteroids, et cetera, that came in. None of them as big and none of them as totally fatal, but the total amount of life that was killed off in this end of the Permian period was the greatest amount ever in the history of our planet as we know it today. Now, maybe totally some other kinds of life may have died off in much earlier times that were just one-celled organisms. But this was a period of time when almost all life was destroyed, and all kinds of life, particularly the largest kinds, or we'll call them species, were wiped out. So it is a big, big change. We're going to come back. I'm going to tell you a lot more about it and how this was affected by the planet, and then how this affected other life and where it all fits together in the big scheme of things. See, we'll be back in, about 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the wise, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And I'm going to continue talking about how life developed on Earth and how it interacted with itself and with the planet and how evolution was, again, being behind the scenes, created by beings, we'll call it gods and God's helpers, to allow life to move in a direction that would eventually create us, but also to co-create with its own planet in an odd way. So let me continue. So at the end of this Permian period, about 250 million years ago or so, volcanoes started belching out all kinds of noxious gases, including carbon dioxide, which is really not that terrible in small quantities. But as it built up in our atmosphere, the world got pretty darn hot. Then another thing happened is that methane hydrate, which is at the bottom of the oceans and usually in a frozen state, started to melt. And it went from a solid state directly into a gaseous state, bubbled up all the way to the surface of the oceans, started to evaporate into the air, and in some cases ignited, because methane is the gas that we cook with. It's the stuff that we call natural gas. And it, as it built up in our atmosphere and even heated it up by sometimes exploding, becoming flame, the planet got very, very hot, because methane is almost two dozen times more potent per quantity than CO2 is at producing the greenhouse effect, which where the heat of the sun comes in, but it can't go out. And so it builds up more and more heat into our world. So the planet became extremely hot. And as it became hot, it also became very dry. And the dryness caused many animals to expire because they couldn't find water. And plants were growing, could not adapt rapidly enough, and so they couldn't grow in that heat, and they started to die off too. So the food chain became inoperative, while animals at the same time did not have sufficient water to drink. And so we had only the very smallest animals able to survive, usually underground, and feeding off the very minimalist types of plants, and for literally millions of years, Earth was almost a non-living place. It had a few life forms in it. There was some life that was able to survive towards the bottom of the sea, and these were very primitive types of life forms. But again, this severe nature to everything created a very strange effect, and that is that it forced life into a very narrow band where it could live either on Earth or sea. And within that narrow band, it had to become unusually capable, tenacious, of dealing with some of the most, we'll say, forceful issues while still keeping itself alive. It had already dealt with issues hundreds of millions of years before that dealt with cold. And it had dealt with issues of low oxygen and high oxygen and other factors, but never one of this level of extreme heat. And also with other events, like I said, there probably were quite a few asteroids after 10 or 20 million years of this extreme heat that also created some problems. So life was really, really challenged. You might say, well, why challenge life so bad? You know, I mean, okay, let's say we'll agree with it that there's a God, and there's God's helpers, we'll call them Logi of planets, or whatever you want to call them, and they're doing all this stuff. Well, what has that got to, why make it so challenging, you know? Why not let life kind of get by, you know? Let all kinds of life just live instead of challenging, and this one dies off, and that one dies off, and, you know. Well, the answer is kind of long range, but I'll put it in these terms. That in order for life to eventually become aware of its own creator, it has to become aware of all of the struggles that could possibly exist within the realm that it is presently, or dimensional area that it is presently existing in. It can't just become aware of only the easy parts. It has to become aware of the difficult parts, because in the difficulties are the challenges for the highest level of creation. Let me say that again. In the difficulties, that's where life has its greatest opportunity to create, and creation eventually has to reach a very high level of co-creation with its own creator for the life form, as us, to be, we'll say, truly completed in its spiritual development. So if animals from 250 million years ago and plants weren't challenged extremely hard, it's very possible that when you get to the point where you're trying to develop human beings, they won't be creative enough. They won't be able to create way beyond, which they need to, the very basic needs. And if they lived in a Garden of Eden with no challenges, they might never find their own creator. Are you following me? Interestingly, H.G. Wells thought of this very concept in a book he wrote called The Time Machine. A guy goes off into the future and finds people, living above ground at least, that are placated with a totally non-challenging life. And they don't seem to have any concept of their creator. And they're used as a food source for beings that are very dark, we'll even say evil, that live below ground. They eat them. And you might say, well, how come that's going on? It's because the beings below ground would supply them with all the necessities of a place to live and food, etc., provided that when they come of age, they eat them. And they don't do much about this because they're not creative enough to find the necessity to be free and to be capable of being conscious enough to say, hey, wait a second, I don't want to be anybody's meal. And besides which, I am in contact with my own creator. And people, when they're like that, when they have that energy going through themselves and that thought with it, they are not easily victimized, because that's what the spiritual part of our creator gives us. Okay, I hope that helps. I don't know. I use these models sometimes, these examples, and sometimes people say, well, you're just confusing me more with whatever H.G. Wells said or whatever. Okay, maybe I am, but I try. Okay, so this is the purpose. The purpose is to create an amazingly challenging environment, not one that is just like, oh, gee, let's just make it very simple and easy. Now, are there some planets that do create much easier models than Earth? Yes. Earth is one of the toughest worlds. And the reason for it is speed. It has to do with time. If you wanted to make it easier, not totally utopian easy, but if you want to make it a little bit easier, the cost would be time. You might eventually get human beings who can become aware of their creator, etc., but it might take 25, 30, 40% longer. And that's a long time if you figure in these hundreds of millions of years for this whole thing to be produced. Boy, it'd be a long, long time. And so Earth chose a time that was very short in which to develop human beings. But that means you had to have some really, really tough animals and plants created that ultimately really were challenged in every way imaginable. So the Permian period was there to ultimately and severely challenge animals and plants so that what came next would be able to deal with just about anything you can imagine and would be one heck of a really tough creature. And what came next were dinosaurs. You might say, oh, it's Jurassic Park and all those other things. That's those things that ran around and ate everything in sight, you know, and were really ferocious. Some of them are really big. You know, it's another group of them. And they kind of plodded along. They kind of were or weren't reptiles or whatever they were. They were something unto themselves. And now many people know they ruled the planet for somewhere around 170 million years. They were around for over 180 million years if you count their very earliest ancestors. That's a long time. 180 million years for a particular kind of life form to be dominant, and I mean really dominant, on a planet is a huge amount of time. Then how did this happen? Well, because the Permian was so severe, there were so many crises, that what was left, what came out of it, was one of the most creative creatures, but no dinosaur was like a human being. It couldn't find its own creator because it didn't have enough senses to do it. It didn't have those two additional senses that are so critical. But what it did do with the senses that it had is it developed those senses in the most creative ways. Dinosaurs, almost by the week these days, are being discovered to be far more adaptable, far more creative, far more capable of having done things that we never even thought. And even having some mammalian characteristics to themselves in some cases, depends upon which type of dinosaur we're talking about. And so here's an animal that, a whole group of animals, of course, that develops the most creative side to itself, but something else also. Dinosaurs developed the most amount of the third part of God's own mind, which has to do with activity and intelligence within it. So most of their creativity was really focused on what is called the third ray type of development, because when dinosaurs came in, it began the development of this focus of round in life, which is to develop an active intelligence. They dominated because they grew bigger than any other animal source and before them, due to this third ray being focused on the planet most of the time in comparison to the other rays, and three at a time. If you remember from last week and before, when we add an additional ray focus, instead of just two, as was happening before dinosaurs, we have three of their chakras being focused on at a time, growing their senses. Their awareness grows much faster. And their ability to, in this case, interact grew enormously. They are much more interactive with their environment, with themselves, and sometimes to the detriment of many other kinds of animals and life forms. So this is what took place. They are the beginning of the third round, which truly began about 225 million years ago. And they were developing from about 245 to 225. It was about 20 million years of development. And then they really took over. And you see this in the fossil record. You see this all over the planet. And a huge change in the way that they interacted with their environment. They took control of their environment, much more so. They actually had a tremendous impact on almost every other kind of life form, be it plant or animal. And it was, I mean, it's just amazing when you think about it, with all the stuff that they did. The huge giant dinosaurs during the Jurassic period. Now, between the Permian and the Jurassic was the Triassic. The Triassic was while dinosaurs were being developed, and the smaller ones got a little bigger, and they started to diversify. And then by about 200 million years ago, you start with the Jurassic period. And during that time, they got huge. They got so big, it was like just a huge, big jump. And they really affected the life of plants because they ate so much of them. plants had to become much more prolific in order to just survive, because these huge dinosaurs are like giant eating machines. And they go around in, you know, groups of them, herds of them, and just clean out a whole forest or a whole savanna area, whatever, just wipe it out, you know. Now, there was no grasses, but when I say savanna, it's more like ferns. Just think of a whole group of ferns, and then just suck them down. And so plants had to become much, much more capable of being fruitful, and the Jurassic period stressed the plants until finally they developed into flowering plants later on, which allowed them to spread their seed more and to become much more prolific. Instead of just being blown around by air, they could be spread by insects. They can do much more with their reproductive process. And so they could keep up with these huge eating machines that would just run around. And dinosaurs put stress on each other and on other life forms because the big ones just pushed all other kinds of life around them out. And then, in addition, dinosaurs ate things that they could eat. Some of the meat eaters could eat almost anything they wanted because they were so incredibly powerful. The third ray produces great power. Power as we have never seen before or since dinosaurs. There were some pretty nasty creatures, the Gorgonoxid, which is a kind of a fast lizard. You think of it as a lizard that's huge, like as big as any mammal we have today, like the super biggest bear. But it wasn't a mammal, it was a reptile. And this thing could just, you know, just about tear apart anything. And it was relatively fast. But it wasn't like a dinosaur. This was before the end of the Permian period. It wasn't like a dinosaur because it was still not nearly as adaptable. And it didn't have the ability to interact with its environment because of its low adaptability or affect its environment as much. It didn't break off into all kinds of numerous species so quickly like dinosaurs did. Dinosaurs very rapidly became all these different kinds of animals, from just a few archetypal lizards types of dinosaurs. They grew into just every kind of imaginable. There was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of species. And they also existed in the oceans. They existed in the air. Amazing, amazing thing. You didn't find that in reptiles before that. Even the ones that were very big and successful. Amazing stuff. Okay, so the third ray really changes everything. Makes things grow bigger, makes them more powerful, causes them to become more adaptable, more interactive, extremely interactive. Interaction isn't just moving around faster. Interaction is having a change and being changed by the environment very quickly. And that's what was really fast about that. Isn't how fast you move, it's how fast you interact with things, how fast you actually cause a change and are changed by the environment. That's what dinosaurs did. They're amazing animals from that standpoint. That's the thing that really I find so fascinating about them. And this developed in eventually all of animal life. It was passed down. It became part of the genetic structure of life itself. It forced plants and animals to become much more interactive, much more one with other parts of life. And we don't think of dinosaurs as really being one with anything, but actually, they were. More and more, it's being discovered that they actually were pretty much bird-like, and some of them were. And many of them were herding animals. They actually did more of that sort of thing than the earlier reptiles before them. Some of it was available in those earlier reptiles, but not to the extreme edges, because there was nowhere near the amount of interaction. They had nowhere near the amount of senses developed and the amount of skills in adapting with everything around themselves. This was truly a revolution in life. Amazing stuff. Okay, eventually dinosaurs reached a point where they were so dominant, this is during the Cretaceous period, they were so dominant that mammalian life, that's where we come from, was put into the corners. Could only exist mostly at night because dinosaurs are pretty much day creatures. And couldn't be very large because if you're big, you get caught by these things and eaten. And so dinosaurs were incredibly successful. And in order for the planet to continue to develop in the next round, which is the fourth round, this is all happening during the third round. Round just tells us how many rays or types of energy are being focused on the planet at one time, which grows so many of the same kind of senses in the bodies. Dinosaurs had three senses being grown at one time. But they had developed so much that for the next round to come in, where four senses were going to be focused on, they had to be virtually eliminated because they were so successful. They were amazingly successful. They were so successful that even for 10 to 20 million years of creating noxious environments with volcanoes and gases and severe earthquakes and all kinds of other stuff that was put into the plan, it only limited them to a relatively small amount. Yes, there were less species, etc., but they still just dominated life on the planet during even the later Cretaceous period. And so, ultimately, there had to be a cataclysmic event to knock them out and destroy them. If that cataclysmic event hadn't happened, they could have gone on living another 10 or 20 million years before these other kinds of conditions would have severely limited them. And that kind of time couldn't be lost. So we have a big rock come out of the sky, and the next thing you know, there's a huge explosion, and most of the life forms, especially the larger ones, are killed. Only small ones, like under about 25 pounds, could survive. Now you can say, well, why didn't only the very smallest dinosaurs then survive? Well, because the good news was that those smallest dinosaurs, many of them had been already severely damaged by other conditions prior to that, such as I mentioned, the changes in the weather and environment. In some places, smaller dinosaurs weren't doing as well because of cold. Smaller dinosaurs weren't doing as well because of changes in the types of gases in the atmosphere. The results were that they couldn't survive earlier, and then so they were weakened, and then the bigger dinosaurs were wiped out by the big event of the rock or asteroid coming from outer space, maybe a comet, but probably an asteroid, that hit the Earth about 65 or so million years ago. And so this was an important aspect of our plan. The plan of our planet was to get rid of those creatures that had the highest level of interaction, but now we're going to have this fourth type of effect coming in. And that effect had to do with the ability to start realizing something about spirit, the ability to sense spirit besides just form, the ability to, for the very first time, have, we'll say, God's touch affecting all creatures, all of animals. It would start with an increase in love and in nurturing, but eventually it would end up moving into much more of what life is about. Now, I can't tell you any more about that because we're out of time. But I hope you're finding that interesting. And this Sunday, September 21st, on 1170 AM, which is in the northeastern part of the United States, if you want to listen in, you can hear me talk about the afterlife, part 6. Or, if you want, go to WDISAM.com and tune in there. And it'll be from 4 to 5 Eastern Daylight Time. And check your own time for when you need to get on and listen. Also, on October 6th, Mimi is going to be talking about the chakras over at Glendale Borders, books and music, from 7 p.m. to 8:15. Tune in, but go and listen to her if you're going to be anywhere in the Phoenix metropolitan area. And I hope you'll have a chance to hear her because I hear that more and more people are enjoying it. And maybe at some time I will drop in too. I'm letting you know that I still will sometimes appear at these things and hope to see you there as well. Okay, so until next week, this has been Niles McFlower, and I hope that next week we will be able to get into getting closer to what being human is all about. So I'll bring in more of that. I don't know for sure we're going to really get to all about being human next week, but we're going to get a lot closer. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.